Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Karen Ashcraft at the University of Colorado Boulder.
Well, Prof. K, thank you so much for doing this. Boulder, a fantastic town, and the university, a fantastic school. So wonderful.
Why, thank you.
And I wondered if we could kick things off by dealing with my rather stereotypical question, which is if you would share with us what's currently dynamizing, retarding, preoccupying, interesting you.
Certainly, and so many things. So where to begin? I'll begin where I suspect many of your guests begin, which is the current political situation, particularly in the U.S., as we have another election cycle approaching and things are heating up. It's the global rise of the far right that has particularly been occupying me for some time, and specifically the way we love to underestimate the work of gender in that process, both globally and where I am locally. So just as an example, right now, there is much talk in the U.S. Shifting from the language of like right-wing populism to Christian nationalism and the particular evangelical turns related to that as a huge part of what is happening in the U.S. But I have been interested in the ways that we keep, though it's right in front of our faces, keep suppressing gender and specifically a kind of masculinity. And the role of that, particularly in the digital organizing of this politic. And in a way, I find myself coming full circle to some things I worked on early in my career, which is specifically the role of women in circulating some of those kinds of masculinities. That's kind of a newer project for me. And I'm also interested in the impact much of this is having on higher ed in the U.S. So that's a range of things, and they're all kind of related for me and percolating. Yeah.
I remember in 2016 thinking that all these reactionary women would go into the polling booth having told their husbands, I'll vote for Donald, and then wouldn't do it. And I was completely wrong.
How'd that go?
Yeah. how's that going for you? Well, not at all. But you... Oh. One of your notable publications, of which there are many, is your book, Wronged and Dangerous, which is in part about these issues, I think, but with a focus on masculinity in particular. Yeah. So I wonder if you could maybe run through us what you think are some of the masculinity issues here, but also some of these things that you're looking at more recently, which involve women and their complicity in the rise of the far right. Because here, you know, in Madrid, the president of the community of Madrid, which is an extremely powerful position, it's sort of like it's beyond being the mayor of Chicago or the mayor of New York or the mayor of Los Angeles, is so far to the right, there aren't even words to describe her. She makes Marjorie Greene look like a liberal. Right.
Those are words. That's a good description.
So,
yeah,
if you could,
sounds like she'd be a perfect case study.
Ayuso, A-Y-U-S-O. She did her undergrad in the department where I work. She was recently given an honorary doctorate without reference to the faculty, and she got her young men to accompany her to the ceremony and give a fascist salute in recognition of her achievement.
Wow.
Fascist salute is illegal in Spain. So she
giving
a case study for you.
Yes, giving Giorgia Meloni a run for her money then. Yeah.
Well, there's every chance she'll be the next leader of the opposition in Spain. However, what I was, rather than going on and on and on about my question, I guess the two elements I wanted to you to ponder, if you would, were the masculinity side of this that you wrote about so powerfully in that book, but also the newer research you're doing into women and their role.
Yeah. Okay, so let me start with the masculinity bit, though your example maybe showcases why my interest in women is heating up, but they're related. So what I write about in that book is something that I call aggrieved masculinity, or manly grievance, or aggrieved manhood, any of those synonyms. And it's basically this feeling that has been on the rise for the last 50 or so years, but really in the last 15 has it taken off globally. Mm-hmm. And I say feeling for a reason, because it is so ideologically flexible, content flexible. It's more of a like physical intensity, right? Or like a felt truth, a conviction. And the feeling is that real manhood is under attack, you know, mm-hmm. that there is one, if we had to pick one identity, despite all these identity politics in circulation, that is truly gotten the, is a victim, you know, is the bad end of the stick, as we say in the US, it is straight white men, frankly, straight white Western, in the case of the US, Christian men. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the fall guy, the bad guy, the one you don't want to be, they're under attack. So a lot of people ask, well, isn't this just toxic masculinity that you're talking about? And it isn't. Toxic masculinity is a term that's kind of pro-feminist in many ways, meant to identify parts of masculinity that are destructive and damaging to men. Parts of traditional or kind of conventional masculinity. Of course, there's so many different kinds of masculinity. So toxic masculinity was this term that began to surface that in sort of public discourse, so we could talk about how boys, for example, or teenagers are harmed by norms of toxic masculinity, not able to show emotions, vulnerability, mental health, things like that. Aggrieved manhood is sort of like a backlash to conversations about toxic masculinity. It is like a doubling down on toxic masculinity and saying, you know what all that conversation has done? It has hurt men. It has been, you know, men under siege. And it is bad for civilization when that happens, because all this critique of toxic masculinity is turning men into soft figures who can't uphold civilization. So what the book is about is really the role that that feeling is playing on the global stage, though I certainly focus on the case of the US, but the role that that feeling is playing in all these kind of movements that we call different things, right-wing populism, white nationalism, various things. They take different names, different places.
Yeah.
And of course, the local dynamics are different. But I sort of talk about that and how that came about, why that has been on the rise, what communication has to do with that, and communication kind of infrastructures. How's that for an intro?
That's great.
Okay.
That's great. And okay, so that's the boy story. What about the gal story, the one that's still developing and an interest in and so on?
Yeah. So one of the things, I start that book with this like primer on a new way of thinking about gender, partly because it seems like anytime I talk about masculinity, and I understand this, people say, so you're talking about men. You're talking about what men do. Like, right. Like you just said, like it's the boys' side of the story.
I was implying that. And of course, I realize that's simplistic and not right. I do appreciate
But I think it's an important thing, actually, because I think this is just a common jump we all make, right?
Yeah.
So that's why I want to mention it.
Yeah.
And the first thing people will say when I start talking about manly grievance is, well, no, it's populism or it's Christian nationalism or whatever the label of the day, because women do it too. And so I am like at pains in that book and sort of ever since to talk about how we can think about the fact that women get deeply invested in certain forms of masculinity, like for really good reasons, through heterosexuality, for economic reasons, because it's really cool to be one of the boys and diss all the other women. So there can be professional gains in it as well. So there's so many reasons.
No, guys just find us cute.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, right.
It is. Okay.
Right.
We're beautiful.
Women who what is it? Women who love men who hate women, something like that. It's like
Well, I mean, all we have to do really is look at divorce rates that correlate with women increasing their own income everywhere, all the time. You know, if women can get free of men, good grief, they do.
Well, that is perhaps another conversation. But in this case, I think it's quite powerful when women are the mouthpieces embodying this particular kind of grievance, because it makes it seem first not gendered. It makes it seem legitimate and not sexist. And it, introduces a whole set of reasons for the entire population to get invested. Yeah, I guess my particular interest in this, growing up in a anti-feminist evangelical household, I learned how to be one of these women. So let me not be righteous about it at all. I very much learned how to kind of turn against other women and how to see that as something to my benefit, something I've been unlearning for my entire adult life, honestly. So there's also that set of interest in it, the gender interest and the,
Yes, I
personal
appreciate
growth.
you're talking about that. I wonder if I could ask another question related. So, when did
Of
feminism
course.
enter your life and how?
Well, I was, as I said, raised really like in the kind of heart of that late 1970s, 1980s religious right ascendance in the US. So very anti-abortion, anti-feminism, anti-gay rights, gay liberation, all these things. And a couple of things. One, noticing the cost that the women in my family consistently paid for self-denial. And that's a long story, but becoming somewhat conscious that they were mentoring me against myself, encountering, I took a gender and communication class, which I now teach. It's so delightful to be able to give back. I took a gender and communication course that kind of widened my eyes and made me think about those dynamics differently. And my escape, honestly, from that environment was to go to graduate school at CU Boulder to study gender and organizations. And that was my quest. And it worked in one sense. But that is when, in college and then my kind of immediate makeover after that is when feminism entered my life in a big way. And, but it's always given me a particular kind of approach to it. Like, I'm always going to be the way we were joking before this podcast began about mansplaining and stuff. I'm always going to want to be playful with it, have compassion and space for people who are anti-feminist. I don't know. That's kind of how I approach my teaching as well. These are complex issues with deep histories. And if we just learn about those histories, that can open up more space for what feminism is about these days, rather than coming straight at it ideologically.
Now, Prof. Karen, this may be entirely incorrect on my part, but as an outsider who's not an expert in any of this material with organizational communication and so on, I perceive a bit of a change, perhaps not a transformation, between or from your earlier publications to Wronged and Dangerous.
Yes, a
Have I
big
got that right?
transition.
Would that
You
be fair to
do.
say? Yeah.
You certainly do. Would you mind if I just trace that briefly? I'll try to be as succinct as possible.
Take your time, take your time. This is not NPR where we have 2 minutes to describe the late Queen's fascination with corgis.
Oh, okay, I don't need to hasten to the sound bite. Oh, here we go. The cat.
The
Can we
cat's
have the
here.
cat's name since it's
Well, he has
participating?
several. His birth name is Chinguri, which is a Basque
Chingudi.
name, which translates into Spanish as ant, which is a weird name for a cat. So he's also Naranja because of his orange color. And I'm telling you, he just eyed off your red head.
I was going to say, for those who are listening, not viewing, there's an alliance happening here.
Well, I hope it will be an
of
alliance.
red
He's
hair.
definitely giving you the look, isn't he?
He sure is. That's great. Okay, so I would say that what has bound over time most of my research interests, my kind of scholarly adventures, is the idea of gender as an organizing principle at practice. And, you know, initially, I was taken with that in what we might think of as like traditional organizational settings, the way that the subfield of communication called organizational communication used to define that, right? So like businesses or for-profit, nonprofit organizations, religious organizations, right? But like things that would recognize themselves as organizations. And so I studied for many years gender as it relates to bureaucracy and alternatives to the bureaucratic form. I then got into gender and occupations. So, for example, I began to study the role of gender, and I always approach this, you know, for all of my career, but increasingly so, never gender alone, gender kind of intersectionally. So we're always talking about specific strands or strains of gender. But I became interested in the use of gender in the birth of the professions. And I specifically studied commercial aviation, just as a case study, information technology, some other sites as well. And I just began to kind of coalesce a lot of my thinking around this idea that what is right in front of us, for example, a male-dominated occupation, which people always take as incidental, or just like maybe it's a coincidence, or it's a relic, or it's a factor of, you know, wartime dynamics or something like this, is actually so much more integral to the formation of the organization or the occupation and the way we understand its worth and value. And in fact, in many cases was strategic, like designed, gender was designed to produce or diminish value. So that really is what gripped a lot of my work. And then, like so many people, this makes me just part of a fad, I suppose. I got taken with the rise of kind of more new materialist ways of thinking, or what some people might think of as relationality theories, and specifically affect, the turn towards studying affect. And that helped me start thinking about organizing and organizing practices in really different ways. And I just, for now, I'll say ways that are more suited to the organization and transmission of feeling online, right? Through social media, through participatory platforms of various kinds. And so it kind of changed my view of organization on the one hand. And I started getting frustrated with how dense a lot of the affect kind of theory writing was. I couldn't find anything. It seemed to me that affect had this extraordinary potential to address the current political situation and what was happening in the particular moment that I was writing was early COVID days. And so I was supposed to be giving a keynote address at Gender Work and Organization in person in June of 2020. And it went, of course, virtual, and it became a public.
You mentioned this in the book, I think.
Yeah. It became a public talk instead. And so they asked us to speak to COVID themes. And so I thought, you know what? I was going to give, for academics, a lecture about like affect is a new way, productive, promising way of thinking about identity. But instead, I'm going to try to give a talk without using the word about the spread of a certain kind of masculinity in this time that is driving COVID lockdown protests. And so I gave this 15-minute talk, and then I got a book contract out of that. And honestly, that is how the transition toward thinking about this in terms of, instead of just organizational politics, which is my familiar ground, in terms of more global politics, cultural politics, opened up. Does that make sense? So
yes.
It's a pretty recent transition in many ways.
But it's not just a theoretical or political change of analytic angle. It's also literary.
Oh, yeah,
You're
change of
writing into
voice,
them
yes.
in a much more conversational, less formally scholarly style.
I'm glad you think
Those
so.
fair
Thank
words to
you.
use.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's still
Yeah.
analytic, it's still theoretical, but
Yeah.
it's, hey, Joe, where are you going to go? You know?
Yeah. Yes. I'm pleased to hear that because I've like flirted with the thought of more public facing or engaged, relevant scholarship that would be accessible. I guess I'm trying to use the terms of. Because no one of those is exactly right. I'm not setting out to do anything in particular, but just like, what would it look like to bring this to bear, some of this theory on ways that you can talk about, with family and friends, right, who are not academics. And so I started experimenting really with Wronged and Dangerous. That is my first experiment with a very different voice and a more conversational. Tell more like my teaching, probably, or more like hanging out with someone. But still, like you say, trying to bring all the resources to bear, but without being so heavy-handed with the, apparatus out front. So.
Well, Prof, returning to something you mentioned earlier as the material turn, I like the Wronged book. I really like a somewhat earlier volume that was co-authored, The Work of Communication.
Oh, yeah, with Tim Kuhn and Francois Caron. Yeah.
And this is where, there's a little bit of Marxism sort of creeping out from under your spectacles or something, right? I mean, you guys talk about different tendencies and materialist analyses of labor exploitation are part of what informs the book, along with other strands.
Certainly, certainly. Yeah, and then it's an attempt to for the labor conditions, which are ooh, many, varied, ever evolving, that seem to be characterizing whatever we call it, late advanced capitalism, right? Where there's kind of a turn away from organizational control as we think of it into what might seem more voluntary, participatory, and empowering, or at least they go by those names, many of the trends, but are in fact deeply concerning in these structural and systemic ways, for all kinds of exploitation. So yeah, that is very much the basis for the
Not part of
book.
what's there.
Yeah,
And
yeah.
another term you used briefly earlier, and that I actually foreshadowed to you, might be one that I felt could do with some elaboration, and that you've said has undergone some significant transformations. No, darling. Sorry, it's my attempt
It's a cat.
to speak to a Basque feline by saying things like, no, darling, which of course are very effective, as you can imagine.
I'm sure of
Namely,
it.
organizational communication. What is it, and what are the transformations that you were alluding to earlier? What is it, and what's gone on with it, I guess?
Yeah. So organizational communication, I'm taking that question to be about the field or the phenomenon or both, perhaps, because
I was
there's a
thinking of the field, but
subfield
I
by
think
that name, but
both would be better, wouldn't it?
yeah. Okay. So, organizational communication is generally, at least, in the last 30 or so years, has been taken as like the process by which collectives become entities, recognizable entities of a kind, right? So, many people think of organizational communication like business communication, like PR statements or memos or technical writing or communications that a business or an organization puts out, right? And that is not how organizational communication folks think of it. We think of communication as like the organizing properties of interaction, right? That scale up into making a group of people that's regularly in some sort of contact and understands themselves to be doing something purposive into an organization with a name that we begin to speak of like a person, right? As if it is a recognizable entity. Yeah. And so, nonetheless, despite the fact that most organizational communications scholars, and it is historically a very U.S.-centric field that has certainly been expanding in the last, I'd say, 20, 25 years. It's now a global field for sure. But I think many organizational communication scholars would claim that communication is far more central to the making of organizations than previously thought. It's not peripheral like we usually treat it, but they would still study organizations, right? So like in contexts, you know, studies of sites that we could call organizations. But increasingly the shift has been toward studying organizing where and however it happens. So if I could just give an example from the book, if that's okay, the Wronged and Dangerous book. One of the things I talk about there is the manosphere, which, you know, media scholars like Sarah Bonet Weiser and many others, colleagues have described as networked misogyny, right? But it's basically a term that refers to like online cyber misogyny, or just like the internet phase of anti-feminist men's movements. And it's just huge. It's been explosive in the last 15 years. It's all over the place. And one would rarely talk about that as an organization, right? Like Weiser's term, Bonet Weiser's term, networked misogyny is maybe the closest we would get to talking about it that way. And why is that? Because a lot of these guys don't know each other. And many of these communities are at cross purposes. They don't understand themselves to be affiliated in any way, right? So how is it operating as an organization? But what I try to show in the book is these super disparate figures. So for example, Andrew Tate, who got a lot of press at one point in the UK, Jordan Peterson, another darling of the manosphere, kind of its intellectual branch. You might think these kinds of masculinities have absolutely nothing in common, right? But what they do in the sort of online space is constantly attract more and more and more attention to the feeling that manhood is under attack, is under siege, that men should be aggrieved. And it's created like grassroots seeming movements all over the world, right? And this is sort of how it's spread. But it is not an organization like we would think of it. It's not a conspiracy. It doesn't have a headquarters, right? It's very diffuse, a hive of activity that is constantly organizing more and more and more of a share of territory of the affective economy. So that would be an example of how the field and I have moved from thinking of the study of communication in organizations to the study of communication as an organizing force. Mm-hmm. Does that help?
That's wonderful. Thank you. Thank you very much. And it's interesting that you're saying as a scholarly domain, it's expanded radically in the last two decades.
Yeah.
Both nationally and internationally. What would you attribute that to?
Well, that's a great question. I think I'm not sure that I would actually say it has expanded nationally. I would say the global reach has expanded. Okay. And I think, you know, there's been many organizational communication scholars whose own circuits of labor have been part of that expansion. So, for example, I became aware of scholars in Sweden, for example, in Scandinavia, at Copenhagen Business School, where I'm about to visit as well. And a kind of network of affiliation between people who do organization studies in a communication curious or communication friendly way began to develop. Now that's also true. I'm just giving that as an example that I've been involved with, but that's certainly been true in many parts in Europe, in Australia, New Zealand, and increasingly in Latin America. There's also, I think, some Eastern European interests as well. And African connections are growing. So it's like kind of people who have been studying similar things are finding one another, is my better explanation of it. It's not that organizational communication, please, can we not have a colonization campaign? Or it's, I don't want to put the label or the name organizational communication on all the folks who I think are doing work that is basically just affiliated with the interests of that subfield.
Understood. And Prof, one of your essays from some 20 years ago, I think co-authored, talks about racial questions.
Oh, for sure.
Organizational communication. And you mentioned earlier that when you teach and write about gender, you're bearing in mind these other social formations and how they intersect or do not with gender in different conjunctures. Recently, I asked an old friend of mine to talk about an essay he'd written about Raymond Williams as a spy novelist. We were recording, and he couldn't remember.
He couldn't remember the essay. Oh my gosh.
He couldn't remember. Well, I mean, to be fair, it did come out 39 years ago, which probably means he wrote it over 40. But it's probably 20 years since you co-authored, I think it was co-authored, this paper.
Yeah, it's over 20 years. So, yes, right. I know
what
you mean.
Is it fair to ask you about it?
It's absolutely fair. And it was a turning point in my work and still informs it. So I first want to just shout out to my wonderful advisor and mentor and dear friend, Brenda J. Allen, with whom I co-wrote that piece.
And some other brothers, I think, also, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We've been collaborating for a very long time. Right. And, you know, it was in our kind of work together that we were thinking through the relationships, as complex as they are, among gender, kind of race, sexuality, all kinds of things like religion, ability, disability, nation, citizenship. Like, it just kept growing, as is the case in many people who are working with what is now abridged as intersectional studies. That particular piece, I think it was called The Racial Foundation of Organizational Communication. And it was about the ways in which, as organizational communication became willing to turn its attention to things like gender, like this, like, okay, fine, we'll let you in. You know, the thing that seemed most unshakable was kind of the whiteness of the field and the ways, what we wrote about is the ways in which it was enshrined in some of the core texts that were used for organizational communication pedagogy, in particular at the graduate and undergraduate level. And it wasn't meant to be accusatory. It was meant to be like, again, we could use my term from earlier, race as an organizing practice, like the ways in which we are all engaged in reproducing whiteness as the normative sort of basis for this field and for what counts as an organization and a worker and things of this sort. And I mentioned that it informs my thinking now. I mean, ever since that time, I have, there's just no way in which you can talk, I think, about gender without also addressing race and colonialism, in the sense that the gender binary is really like a racial and colonizing formation. The idea that the gender binary is a universal device by which we can understand the split of men and women is a historical device that was extremely invention, that was extremely important to colonizing efforts. And if you ever wonder why people are clinging so intensely to the binary today, for example, transphobia, you know, all the things that we have going on in culture wars that are like men and women, the binary is natural. There's a reason. I would love to talk about that more if we had a chance as well. The point is, it's impossible really to talk about what is happening now in relation to aggrieved manhood, for example, or the role of women in it, without talking about race and racialization. Just if we could use the illustration of something, I don't know if all your listeners would be familiar with this, so you tell me, but the rise of kind of white nationalist thinking around great replacement theory, which is getting a lot of traction Should I say more about that or briefly?
It originated in France. And so a lot of European listeners will know about Monsieur Camus' weird ideas, but they may not know how it's been taken up by great intellectuals like Tucker Carlson.
Indeed.
In the States. So I think giving it some resonance in the US would be helpful. Yeah.
Sure. In the US, the particular traction, as you said, is about this threat that like the white voting population is under attack and is going to be replaced, there's the term, by brown folks who will become the majority of the voting populace. And so it's used as a sort of fear, a threat, they're coming. It can be vaguely about foreigners and immigration, migrants. It can also be about domestic kind of representations of brownness and blackness as an uprising threat. So it's used in various ways, but almost always, including the time you just referenced when Tucker Carlson, when he still had that giant mouthpiece that was his Fox primetime show, when he took it mainstream, and that was already happening elsewhere, the uproar in response is like, this is naked white nationalism, white supremacy, etc. But what we do not discuss is the fact that it is also crucially tied to anti-feminism and to gender, right? So specifically, it's about breeding patterns, you know? And for most great replacement folks nowadays, the kind of boogie person is white women who have fallen down on their reproductive duties thanks to feminism and many other things and are not performing their racial duty to reproduce, right? And so like these things are thoroughly intertwined. You can't talk about Christian nationalism or the white nationalist agenda without talking about the gender agenda that is pivotal to that, right? So that's what I mean when I say we underestimate gender. And also one must always talk about these things in connection. Yeah.
And when you wrote that piece with Prof. Allen, that marked some sort of transformation for you intellectually, politically, personally, going back 20 years?
I would say more so intellectually. I had personally, like my finding of feminism was simultaneously a finding of critical race theory and well, other things that in the US now are devil terms, but just generally rereading my own kind of infancy and growing up years in the light of like the kind of civil rights movements, feminism, all the things that my kind of family nexus was responding to against. I sort of relearned about all of that from another, you know, more intellectual and historically faithful perspective. Sure. And that's really what opened, I think, me to it. And then I deepened my intellectual roots in critical race studies for sure, in the act of and after writing that piece with Brenda Jay.
And please don't feel pressure to be more personal in your answer than you're comfortable with. But what was it like speaking to the family after these transformations you went through, which presumably started when you were about 18 or 19?
Yeah, it was
going. Was it tough, you know, going home after first semester at college and saying, I disagree or whatever?
Yeah, my grand plans of where to go to school, I come from a family that on the one hand sees itself as very populist, but also had the economic means to send me away to school. But they decided that they didn't want to do that for my sister and I because we were women and we would likely get married. This in the late 80s, right? But still, okay, that's where they were. And this is in the Bay Area also, I should say, in California.
Hot so like San Francisco Bay Area.
Yes, yes. Yes, so many different influences, right? So I mentioned that because I didn't go away to school. I instead went to this small commuter school called Cal State Hayward, now Cal State East Bay, California.
Oh, yeah. So did you live in the East Bay? Where did
oh,
you
sure did. That's where I was raised. Yes. Yes. So I didn't go away to school. So it was like a simultaneous, like learning all this stuff and sort of having an awakening about like, whoa, almost like a, if I can use this term as a former evangelical, like a conversion, you know, for them, it appeared to be a conversion, right? And it was in a sense. So there was a great deal of friction. For a time, we have been on and off estranged, but we have also managed to stay in relationship even through the Trump years. It certainly, that's a work in progress or a work in backlash as well. It's not always in progress, but there's always a personal aspect of this work for me. Yeah. Oh.
Of course, and I appreciate your frankness. I wanted to tell you a quick story. During the campaign for the 2016 plebiscite for peace in Colombia, I was living there, and there was a big protest in the coastal region in the Caribbean where I was working. Mm-hmm. And Afro-descended Colombians are mostly in that Caribbean coast, for listeners who may not be aware of this. And there's no black middle class in Colombia. I mean, very few people have any opportunities whatsoever. Mm. The poverty and oppression they suffer is grotesque. And white girls, and particularly blonde white girls, will always be upper middle class and would have no connection with black Colombians. Mm. During that campaign, because in the ill-advisedly sort of 300-page manifesto for a yes vote for the plebiscite. So, you know, the Brexit lesson is one sentence. Do you want to leave the European Union? You win. 350 pages, you lose. But what evangelical Christians in the US lit upon were two promises. You can guess where I'm headed. One was equal rights for women, and the other was marriage equality. So they spent millions of bucks on the No campaign for peace. Mm-hmm. And they managed to construct events that crossed these powerful racial and class divisions. So I would see in these demonstrations a black boy and a blonde girl holding hands. It's not yeah. quite like Alabama in 1958, but not far off.
Yeah.
Completely yeah. natural, accepted, understood because of the power of gendered beliefs within the movement. Mm-hmm. Absolutely staggering. Probably not a surprise to you, but it blew me away.
Yeah. Yeah. And these things can be rearticulated, you know, all the time. And this really is what I meant earlier about how it is that white women in particular are sort of shown or come to discover their investments mm-hmm. in certain racial arrangements, right? Mm-hmm. Or in certain religious formations mm-hmm. or patriarchal formations. Mm-hmm. It's, yeah.
It's but stunning. It was, I mean, I thought of that because of what you'd said earlier about mm. wanting to keep dialogue open.
Yeah.
And because this to me incarnated the ability to do that. I, of course, mm. as you said, wanted to rearticulate it rather radically.
Yeah, yes.
It wasn't my place to do so, either in gender yeah. or racial or national terms.
Yeah.
But they found a means through evangelical belief to cross divides that
yeah.
were super powerful.
Yeah.
Super powerful. And so there's something there to be learned along with. If you're going to have a vote on a referendum, don't make it over a document.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
as long as the New Testament, right? So, Prof, I wanted to ask you, if I may, two more questions, and then mm-hmm. to conclude, throw it to you to add anything you might wish to what we've said. Does that sound okay as a way of?
Of course, sure.
Coming to a conclusion? So, yeah. The first question is a sort of boring, you know, promotion and tenure committee question.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
I love those. That animates all of us.
I can't answer this sort of question, so I love asking other people, how do you know what you know?
How do I know what I know? Well, I mean, there's a couple of scholarly answers I might give. I mean, one of those is ethnographic in character. And I actually think that it bridges the scholarly and the personal that we've been describing, which is that when you are immersed in something, when you inhabit it, when it has become an almost like reflex, second nature practice to you, and you have both made it strange enough, created distance enough that you can reflect on what you know about that practice. Mm. There's a kind of insider knowledge that becomes possible. And I say this as somebody who both practices qualitative and ethnographic research and has for 30 years and has come to understand that through certain scholarly techniques and conventions about that. But also, as I have been coming to terms with what you have just mentioned about evangelical histories and, you know, personal familiarities with anti-feminism, populism, religious right, things of that sort, a way of like surfacing and working with embodied knowledges that had been suppressed for some time. So that's one answer. There are other ways I could answer that, but I feel like that one bridges two sides of this conversation, which is, you know, I stand by many of my gender claims and race claims and so forth about organizing on the basis of careful research, much of it, though not always ethnographic. And there are some things that I do and know, for example, in that book, Wronged and Dangerous, that I couldn't do without having lived the life I have.
Thank you very much for that great response.
And in no way was that a boring question. I love how you're like teeing it up, like it's going to be a defense.
And my last question, Prof, before throwing to you to bring things to a close, is to go to this word you used earlier, transphobia. Where does this, and we have it here in Spain hugely, by the way, monumental anxiety arise about trans people in the United States? What is impelling it? Propelling it, sorry.
Yeah. Well, so first, shouting out to queer theory colleagues, there is a whole history to anti-trans activity, intensities, and so forth that I won't trace here, but it's important to acknowledge in its own right as a way of kind of understanding the moment that we are in.
Yeah.
And I mentioned earlier that I would love a chance to talk about what the gender binary is doing right now. And I think this is it. This is a great chance. So what is propelling it? What is spreading this kind of transphobic? Well, I think it is important to understand that when it comes to grievance politics, call it whatever you want in any local form that it takes, right? Right-wing populism seems to be the word that many settled on, you know, in recent times. It is much easier to spread that kind of culture war on something that runs as a binary, right? Like you cannot spread globally localized racial resentments. People can't possibly understand from one context to another. They can understand racism, right? As an organizing device, but the specifics, right, of the resentments and so forth. Mm-hmm. There are few really other dynamics that offer the simplicity of man, woman, manly rights, wronged, right? Just this like very clean binary formula. So there is an attachment to the binary that is as strategic and organizational as it is for some folks religious, for some folks, you know, there's all kinds of, like I said, content reasons why people will attach to this. But the commitment to the gender binary as a naturalized phenomenon is the anchor of the particular kind of like patriarchal white supremacy dynamics that are happening right now. It is the anchor. And transphobia serves that in a particular way. It like ensures that it's the natural binary and not a chosen one, right? Mm-hmm. That men must be men if that is how they're born, right? So it's intimately related to these dynamics. And it is, I think, not everybody understands the strategic role that the binary plays, but some of the masterminds of these campaigns certainly do.
Wow. One of the attacks on Begoña Gómez, the wife of the president of Spain, Pedro Sánchez, who today decided after 5 days of reflection not to resign, despite the attacks on her, which are about influence peddling and corruption. But one of the side attacks is that she's actually trans and that she comes from a family of pimps, for want of a better term. And so every kind of gender assault is being made on this couple, and every kind of discrediting of him is being done through these extraordinary assaults on her. And of course, being labeled trans doesn't ipso facto mean something negative, unless you're not choosing to name yourself that. And perhaps you're not that, right? Category of person. Yeah. So it's very, very alive here. And this isn't just the work of the lunatic fringe. This is the work of right-wing journalists who are very powerful in this country. So you were talking about the US, but I think the lessons from the US that I asked you to give can be applied here. And I should say that the far right in Western Europe and in Eastern and Central Europe has Steve Bannon as the master blaster.
Yeah, this is one of the things I have both tried to study, trace, and show in my writing is the actual sort of networking connections among these things. It's not like it's just cropping up everywhere. It is best thought of in terms of like spread, diffusion, right? Like you use the term propelling. And there is an energy source and there are architects. And they are working from a model that, you know, I think many, many citizens, for example, around me, say things like, what critical race theory, transphobia, you know, drag queen, whatever, like, what's the latest culture war trigger? What do all these things have in common? This is what they have in common.
Oh, that's
they're serving aggrieved manhood.
That's beautifully put, Prof. Thank you. So to conclude, I wonder if there are things that we haven't touched on that you'd like to mention, or things we have discussed where you want to add something.
Well, it's been a wide-ranging conversation in terms of both my organizational communication self and research interests, but also global politics. And maybe I would end with an encouragement of sorts to not get caught up in the understandably, this isn't to you in particular, but maybe to myself and to those listening, like an invitation to maybe not fixate on the question of whether democracy will stand or are these things good for democracy? Can it withstand? I think something I've been trying to show and write about quite a lot is the ways that this strain of masculinity that I'm talking about is actually a public health challenge and is can be diffused a bit or disarmed when it is thought of in that way rather than as a political threat or only a political threat. If you think about everything from current environmental politics and climate change and the role of aggrieved manhood in resisting climate-friendly policy at the governing level, you can think Trump here as just one example. There's so many aspects. Supremacy crimes on the rise in many places in the world, including U.S. example, mass shootings. I mean, many of these kind of phenomenon have aggrieved manhood at their heart. And it is important for us to think about how the spread of this is threatening the future of the planet and everyone's well-being and not just political fates or even the fate of political systems. Maybe that's something I'd mention.
Thank you so much. It's been a great, great privilege to talk to you, Professor Ashcroft. I've learned much from your work over the years, but it was special to have this opportunity to learn from you almost in person.
Thank you so much. It was a delight to chat with you too.